You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Welcome to the Nighttime Podcast. I want to prepare you up front. This episode will be a little bit different than previous ones. To some, this may be my darkest, most troubling episode yet, where others may find it the breath of fresh air they've been longing for. Now let me explain that. When one considers the world's many great mysteries and unexplained events, there's often a medley of possible explanations ranging from the likely to the impossible. For example, an unidentified sound in the forest may be caused by a Sasquatch, but it could also be explained by something more typical, say the rummaging of a bear. Myself, being predisposed to analytical and realistic ways of thinking, I often find my love of great mysteries tempered by the favoring of their most plausible explanation. With that said, I wouldn't be able to get swept up in a story that to me seems like nothing more than an average event. So rest assured, the stories I present on the Nighttime Podcast are ones that are compelling enough for me to capture my attention, which in turn leads me to research them and share my findings with you. Gauging by the emails and comments I receive, I know there are listeners who have little interest in the paranormal, claiming it's all too far-fetched and unlikely. Now, if that's you, I believe you'll welcome this episode with open arms. And for my listeners who favor the explanations that exist on the fringe, this episode may likely make your skin crawl. For tonight's episode, I've invited Brian Dunning, host of the science and education podcast Skeptoid, to help provide a critical analysis of two recent Nighttime Podcast episodes, specifically the Oak Island Mystery and the Bell Island Boom. Now, in a recent conversation, Brian and I spoke at length about his work, skepticism, and both Oak and Bell Islands. Tonight's episode is that discussion. So without any further delay, here it is. When did your show Skeptoid begin, and what was it that led to you creating this sort of show?
So I studied computer science in school and double majored with film and writing for film and television. I never worked in either field, mainly because I'm just lazy. I've always been into science, and if I went back to school now, I would go into hard sciences, but I just didn't have I wasn't disciplined enough for it at the time. So it wasn't until really the mid-1990s when podcasting became a thing that I finally found the career that put together everything that I was interested in, that I'd studied for, that I was ready to do. So I started doing a science podcast and with a focus on kind of urban legends and weird things because, like so many people in my field, that's the books that I read when I was a kid. I read all the books about UFOs and Bigfoots and ghost stories. I'm all, wow, that's amazing. And was just grew up obsessed with these ideas. And now finally that I'm semi-adult, I can sit and spend professional time looking into them, yeah. Stroking my passions, as it were.
So when was it that the show actually launched? Do you recall the date? The year?
October of 2006. So, This is the 10th year of Skeptoid.
Congratulations on 10 years of it. I think I've listened to everything in probably the last 4 or 5 years. That's when I first got turned on to podcasts. I don't know what led me to it, but it was one of the first that I actually got into. I think what it may have even been is just opening the podcast app and just searching Oak Island and listening to any shows that covered it. So that's likely how I got into it.
That could have been. Also, 5-6 years ago, it was a lot easier to be on the front page of iTunes.
Yeah.
Now it would be a much harder proposition.
Good point. Now, your show is, the emphasis is on skepticism. Can you just explain in some basic terms what skepticism is or what that entails?
Skepticism is basically applying the scientific method to things that we hear in popular culture. Somebody tells me that they're on the miracle juice cleanse that'll detoxify your body and make you miraculously healthy. Well, a skeptical perspective would then be to apply the scientific method to that claim. What are these toxins you think you're removing? What is the power of this fruit to somehow bind with this toxic molecule and flush it out of your body? What's the mechanism there? So basically, we demand some kind of a standard of evidence for things like that. The best way to describe it is the intersection of science literacy and consumer protection. The better basic understanding of science that you have, the better equipped you are to make good decisions about your life, avoid getting ripped off by lame products like juice cleanses that don't do anything at all. And you can apply the same methodology to all of these stories that we were just talking about, Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts, Oak Island, things like that, that I always loved and was really delighted to have sort of a professional opportunity to look into. So for me, scientific skepticism it's an exploration. And it's a wonderful exploration because it always yields treasure.
I find myself, I'm conflicted with the whole thing because I'm such a dreamer and I love these stories. I'm always seeking them out and I get so deep into it. So when I listen to your show, it almost reminds me of the feeling you get at the end of a wild night at the bar when they turn the lights on. And all of a sudden, what was once, strobe lights, smoke machines, and pounding music is now just a big, silly room. And I mean that as a compliment with your show. And my favorite episodes of your show start with this great mystery. And, as you're describing the mystery, the first 3 minutes of the show, I'm falling so into it. And then by the end of it, you build such a compelling case for, this often mundane or just this very basic explanation. So to me, you do what Dana Scully should have been doing all along with Fox Mulder. You're just much better at it than she seemed to be.
I think you hit on it. The idea is never to simply poo-poo things or to rain on someone's parade or to take away their cherished belief, to tell them their ghost isn't real, that it was a chair that fell over, whatever. The idea is to give people something. Don't take away. Give people something. Why do we think that there's a ghost in this picture? What is the psychological perceptual phenomenon? What is it that our brain is doing that makes us think that? When we believe in a conspiracy theory that whatever it is, the New World Order consists of reptilian aliens controlling all the world's corporations, there's actually really interesting psychology and sociology behind that. So you're not just poo-pooing something or raining on a parade. You're actually giving people something that's new and exciting. I want everyone to listen to one of my episodes of Skeptoid and go, huh, that's really cool. I learned something new. Not just, oh, well, that's a bummer. And that's a big difference.
Yeah, and also another thing, and I'm sure you deal with this a lot, is when being involved in the paranormal or, the conspiracy circles or whatnot, skepticism can be viewed in a negative light where it's accusing someone of being a skeptic rather than practicing skepticism. Can you just talk about that briefly?
Yeah, it's a terrible word, first of all. If I were to go back in time, I would not call my show Skeptoid because having that S-K-E-P in it immediately gives a negative connotation right off the bat. People say, oh, skeptics, oh, you're the people who think the government was behind 9/11 or whatever it is. It's always something negative. They think it's people equate it with cynicism, with negativity. That's the way we use the word skeptic or skepticism in normal conversation. And I understand that. And that's why I would change the name if I were to go back in time, because it's not about that at all. For scientists, for people following the scientific method, skepticism is a core guiding principle of how we develop knowledge and how we learn.
One topic we've both covered in the past is the Oak Island treasure hunt or the mystery of Oak Island, as well as the Bell Island boom. Now, I actually discovered the Bell Island boom through your show. I had, despite having been there and lived very near there, I had never heard of it. So the reason I invited you here, one was to introduce Nighttime Podcast listeners to Skeptoid, but the second would be for you to help my listeners and I take a skeptical look at what may have happened on these two Atlantic Canadian islands.
Mm-hmm.
So let's begin with Oak Island. Anyone who knows me would tell you I've been hopelessly swept up in this mystery since I first heard about it, which was probably somewhere between maybe 8 to 10 years old. For anyone unfamiliar with Oak Island, I've covered it extensively in the past myself, but boiled down to its most basic explanation, for the last maybe 220 years, various people have been digging for something, possibly, hopefully for them, treasure on a small island in Mahone Bay, Nova Scotia. During the history of the search, there has been evidence of man-made objects and structures unearthed, and various theories have been put forward on what's buried there, who buried it, how they buried it, and why, perhaps, they buried it there. So if you could tell me if you recall how you first heard about the island.
I first read about it in a little Reader's Digest compilation of stories for kids. And I read this probably when I was 8 years old. And actually, when I got your email before the show, I looked in my bookshelves to see if I could find that book, because I'm pretty sure I still have it. But I decided it's in a box up in the attic, and at that point, it was past the point of diminishing returns, and so I didn't find it. But yeah, it captured my imagination exactly the same way you describe. I was a little kid. I was reading this story about a little kid my age, or maybe a little older, who rowed his boat out to an island and found what appeared to be a pirate treasure. And I won't lie to you. I mean, I read Tom Sawyer a million times when I was young, and this is exactly the same kind of thing that I used to do. It just appealed to me immediately at a very gut level. I was thrilled with the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the episode you've done on it, I thought the case you built was very compelling. Could you describe the research you would have conducted for that episode, or just in general the research you put into your episodes?
Yeah, so at the time when I did the Oak Island episode, I was about 2 years into doing Skeptoid, and I had already learned by then that you must completely dismiss all of the popular nonfiction books written about mysteries like this, because they tend to always plagiarize from one another. They literally copy and paste paragraphs back and forth. They don't do any original research. They simply read something else that sounds sensational, copy and paste it into their book, and move on to the next story. It's very disappointing. And for most people who are aware of the Oak Island money pit to some degree, that's the quality of the information that they have been given. There actually is a lot more to the story than what you'll get from reading books on it, reading websites about it, watching the TV show about it, what have you. So what I did was, of course, I started with all of that to get the legend, to get the popular version of the story. But then to actually find out what's really going on, you then go to the scientific literature, because believe it or not, actual geologists have been to the island and they have published papers in scholarly journals about it. We do know what's going on underground there. We do know what's going on with the geology. We do know what's going on with the history of the area. And a lot of these things that are suggested to be simply mysteries that are unknown, actually they are known. They're just not part of the pop sensational version of the story.
Mm-hmm. It's everybody likes a good story, and it's just like how gossip gets around. People want to hear a fantastic story, so I get that. But when looking at all the evidence that's there in what you went through during your research, what is it that you believe that the various Oak Island theorists and treasure hunters are misunderstanding? What is the main mistake you think they're making?
Well, the main mistake they're making is they are only looking at their preferred sources. They are dismissing sources which they perceive to be coming from outsiders, like those pesky science journalists and those pesky skeptics. They have their preferred narrative, the version of the story that they want to believe, and only other people who embrace that part of the story are valid sources from their perspective. Now, I've never met any of the people personally who are popularly associated with Oak Island, so I'm not suggesting this as a factual claim about anyone. Maybe they warmly embrace scientific research. I don't know. But from everything I see them talk about on the TV show, everything I see them write about online, in my perspective, it's clear that they do not, that they very soundly reject a skeptical perspective.
Now, do you have any theory yourself as to what happened on Oak Island or what the history is?
Well, you want me to spill the beans? What?
Let's solve it right now.
Okay, solving it right now. So, as we know, the popular version of the story is that there was this very ingeniously dug shaft that had all of these sort of booby traps in it. You dig past a certain point, suddenly it fills with water because there is some diagonal shaft cut up to the ocean, allowing the water to flood the shaft. There was these compelling platforms made of logs sealed with coconut fiber that could only have been done by skilled engineers. And it was very, very deep. Well, that sounds great. And that sounds like, wow, gee, nobody back in the 1700s actually had the technology to dig anything like that. So it really invites wild speculation. What it doesn't tend to invite is natural explanations. And phenomena like the Oak Island Money Pit have happened all around the surrounding area. It's not unique. And it's not that these are all pirate treasures buried all over the place. They're simply natural sinkholes. And that sounds like, oh, that's a bummer, or oh, that couldn't be true because of all these things. They found gold coins. They found all this other stuff down in the shaft. But let me explain. When you have a natural sinkhole like this, and others were found on Oak Island before the whole incredible island was tractored up and run over by steam shovels and everything, but on the mainland as well, you've got these sinkholes. And when they're open to the air, storms come over, especially on low-lying islands like this. Maybe storms only every 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. They fill it with debris. They fill it with floating wood. It fills with dirt over the years. It fills with coconuts that do float up that far from the southern latitudes. And all of this debris and junk collects in this hole and gets gradually buried over the centuries. Then you see a shallow depression on the surface, and you start to dig down. You find, oh, look at all these logs that washed in some storm, but you don't know that. It doesn't seem like it. They would have just washed in naturally, but they did. They do all over the place in that area. And here's coconut fiber. How could coconut fiber get buried 100 feet down? There's no coconut trees around here. It must have been brought by pirates. It's all of these things that seem like clever explanations for something that is a natural explanation, just not necessarily an obvious one. It's actually pretty interesting. Now, the reason we have these sinkholes is because this is very porous limestone. It's full of these underground caves and caverns and shafts and these voids in the rock. And that's why when you dig into it, suddenly it'll flood with water. You can't dig a hole anywhere around there without it flooding with water because it's all this very porous limestone. So then we come to the question of, okay, well, what about this tablet that had this Masonic code written on it saying 20 feet below $1 million is buried or whatever it said? And they find gold links of chain and whatever coins or other strange things they may have found in there. That has to be proof that it's some sort of a treasure. Well, there is a tradition in mining speculation called salting a mine. When you want to sell a mine or when you want to get additional investors involved to finance further developing your mine, it's common to do what's called salting your mine, which is you take something valuable, you throw it in the mine, you say, oh, look at this, look what we just found. Investors go, oh my gosh, how much money do you need? And that's the fairly obvious explanation for all of the, there's the, you know, the scrap of parchment, bits of metal, links of gold chain, all of these things that they say were found in the mine. They weren't found in the mine. Read any history of mining, especially in the wild speculation, wildcat days of the California gold rush. This is not unique at all. This is very, very old hat stuff. Anyone who's been in the mining industry laughs their head off when they read about finding links of gold chain in the Oak Island money pit because they know exactly how that got there. Geologists laugh their head off when they hear people talking about the Royal Corps of Engineers was the only people that could have cut a shaft that would cause this to flood. It's basic stuff that is not part of the general public's frame of reference. I hadn't heard of any of these things before, so I don't know about them, so I look at what I see, and I don't have the explanation, so it seems miraculous and wonderful to me. That's basically it.
This is why your show is so incredible, because it's with so many mysteries, you can boil it down to the most basic terms like that. That being said, I absolutely do not want to believe you. But it hurts me because you make so much sense when you explain it. Here's one thing, and this is one reason why your explanation for me is so valid and holds so much water. Pardon the pun. Where I'm from, I lived on a small dead end street on Cape Breton Island, which isn't too far away from Oak Island, except it's a lot bigger. But in my neighborhood, we had this area. It was just behind some of the houses in a wooded area. We called it the pit. And I don't know who on my street, which of the neighborhood kids discovered this place, but it was basically a depression in the ground. And we all started digging in it all the time. And I don't think that we were inspired by Oak Island. I don't know what led us to digging there, but we were finding all these old like bottles and random pieces of metal and just odd stuff. And when we started telling our parents that we had been digging in this pit and finding stuff, our parents had told us that years ago, that's where where they used to throw away garbage. What they would bring is like your old fridge you'd throw in there. And if you went back, you know, the next year, the ground was starting to swallow it up. So really what it was just a sinkhole that was near our house that you know, 80 years ago, everyone was throwing their old appliances and stuff in there. And often when I think of your theory or similar theories on Oak Island pointing towards a sinkhole, I think of the pit that the neighborhood kids and I dug in often. And it does make sense to me.
I had one of those too, except it was old cars that would, it was a little canyon that every time it rained, this canyon would get dug out twice as big. And for some reason, people would abandon cars in it.
Huh. I guess it makes sense if the planet is going to do that for you. But I could see that as a possible explanation for Oak Island. That being said, there are so many theories. And for me, what I love about Oak Island and my fascination is not solving the riddle. It's basically just looking at all the pieces of the puzzle, looking at the history and all the, you know, the interesting players like Dan Blankenship, who's lived there for so long, and Fred Nolan, who's done all the land surveying. And actually, rest in peace, Fred Nolan. He just recently passed away. But for me, it's the history and just the massive puzzle that draws me in. Now, given the way you feel and your theory on Oak Island, does that affect your interest in it? Like, are you watching the TV show, or do you still think about Oak Island in that way?
It absolutely does not diminish my enthusiasm for the story at all. And I'll tell you why. Because the reason I got into this business in the first place was because I wanted to solve the mysteries. And when you stop at sort of the popular supernatural, paranormal, not in this case, but for most of these stories, whether they're ghost stories or whatever, when you stop with the popular explanation, you're deciding that you're not going to take the next step and solve the mystery. I wanted to actually solve it. I want to know what was really going on here. And when you read about this stuff and you find out that, oh, people a lot smarter than me have already solved this, and here's what they found out, and here's what they know, here's how they know it, here's why we can tell that it's true, to me, that's fascinating. And not only is it fascinating, it's real. So I'm thrilled to have the solution to this particular mystery. And it doesn't at all take away from me the fascination that this boy must have felt back in, what year was it? 1790?
I know it was 221 years ago.
1795, yeah. Daniel McGinnis, mm-hmm. And he was 16 years old. I can imagine, like it was me myself, what he must have felt when he got there and found this block and tackle suspending from a branch. Actually, the block and tackle turns out that it's apocryphal. Does not appear in the earliest newspaper accounts. So that's probably a detail to the story that was added later. But nevertheless, whatever he found was convincing enough to him that it looked like a pirate treasure was buried there. And to me, that's just thrilling. And for 40 years later, then 30 years later, to actually find the solution, I feel like he finally found what he was looking for. To me, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And there's been, you know, whatever it is about the island, it does manage to draw people in, because again, going on 220 plus years, how many people have lost either their lives or fortunes, you know, being hopelessly invested in it. So there is something, maybe you may have solved the riddle to the Oak Island money pit in terms of its physical, what physically is going on there, but perhaps there's some paranormal thing going on that's drawing these people in that you've yet to solve. So I think your work is not done on Oak Island, Brian.
Well, I tell you what, it goes back to the intersection of science education and consumer protection. I can be thrilled by the story, but I'm certainly not going to invest any money with the people who are trying to dig up pirate treasure on the island. So I have protected myself as a consumer with my science education, thanks to skepticism.
You are good. So let's move on now to another great mystery that happened on another relatively small island in Atlantic Canada, this one being the Belle Island boom of 78. The basics of what happened was an anomalous aerial event or explosion that led to puzzling damage on the Bickford Farm and some of the surrounding area. Now, aside from the direct physical damage to the Bickford Farm, there was also some reports of bizarre events, most notably stationary glowing balls of light and an odd metallic haze that was said to be visible both before and after the blast. Now, I first heard about this story actually from your show. Do you recall when you first found out about this?
This was one that I had not heard of myself, and it was sent in by a listener suggesting that I look into this. And just the name, Belle Island Boom, sounded cool. So I went to Wikipedia and said, "Ooh, that sounds neat." And then eventually I did the full research and writing on it.
Yeah, a fascinating story. And being, again, I'm not far from the area. I've been to Belle Island before, been around Newfoundland, have never heard of this story. And even when I was doing my research in my telling of it, I was going on like Facebook groups for like people from Belle Island or people who lived in the area just to try to get in touch with somebody from the Bickford family or just maybe even some eyewitnesses. And I was surprised at how few people knew this story. I thought it would have been a much bigger deal.
It's one of these things that it became a big deal because of its potential implications, but as far as what actually happened that day, there was a loud noise on the island, and that's pretty much the end of it. 15 minutes later, people were going about their business, and nobody thought too much more about it, except for the Bickfords, of course, who had to call an electrician. But I'm not surprised to hear that it's not a big deal among the locals there. I'm surprised they're not selling t-shirts and making some money off of it. Hopefully some of them are.
Yeah, perhaps. But I've actually, on my show, I interviewed one of the Bickfords. She was 17 at the time, lived in the home. She still lives in the firm now. And so she spoke to me about it. And she was, she didn't seem like the type that would be trying to make money off it. She was the sweetest lady I think I've ever spoke to. And if I ever go to Belle Island, I'm going to go see her for tea, I hope.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Now, with the story and all the bizarre reports that have happened, you know, the electrical damage, what do you make of this story?
Well, what intrigued me the most about this was when I read that secret agents from the United States Army or the military or some secret science lab somewhere were milling around after it happened.
Said to be from Los Alamos, I believe.
Yeah. and you know, not only does that, first of all, raise a big red flag for me as something that's probably not true or that was misreported, it explains why it had such a long, why the story would grow such long legs, especially on the internet, especially in the conspiracy theory community. But then when I dug further and watched some of the original television news reports and looked at some of the original newspaper articles on it, I found that these guys from Los Alamos actually were there. And that really grabbed my attention. So what is Los Alamos guys sending people out here to this boom unless there's some truth to these stories that it was a test of a secret super weapon or something like that? So as far as a mystery coming across my desk, this was by far one of the more interesting ones.
The explanation I've heard for the presence of the investigators, I guess, from Los Alamos was that they were, well, I've heard the conspiracy theory angle of that they were there, you know, seeing how well their secret weapon worked. But I've also heard that they were there studying ways to harness electricity, where the official cause of this, as far as the Canadian government announced, was that it was some type of super-powered or supercharged ball lightning. So I believe the story is that they were there investigating, you know, how that works and something to do with the lightning. Have you ever been able to figure out exactly what they were doing there?
Yes, I did. Now, there was two guys there. Their names were John Warren and Robert I'm not sure if it's Freiman or Freeman. From Los Alamos National Lab. At the time, it was called Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory in New Mexico. One of them was working on the Vela satellites, and the other one was working on something to do with, I don't recall exactly, something to do with atmospheric weather stuff. Mm-hmm. And the Vela satellites were a constellation of satellites that we launched, that the United States launched specifically to spy on Soviet nuclear tests. If the Soviets detonated a nuclear weapon, the Vela satellites would detect it. That was the purpose of these. So these guys are constantly looking at the Vela satellite data and looking at the pictures that are sent down, and they discovered something completely unexpected that had nothing to do with the Soviets, but which later was determined to be lightning superbolts. And the Vela satellite program spying on the Soviet Union ended up discovering a previously unknown atmospheric phenomenon. It's just a gigantic lightning bolt that originates much higher in the atmosphere than the regular lightning that you and I see. Sometimes it doesn't even make it all the way down to the ground. It's just way up in the upper atmosphere. And sometimes these bolts do make it all the way down to the ground, where they are so many orders of magnitude more powerful than regular lightning that they can actually cause real damage, as we saw at the Bickford farm. So the one guy is looking at the Vela satellite data, and he says, oh, what the heck is this? And I just heard in the newspaper that these people in Bell Island reported that there was a big loud boom heard all over the island. So he ran down, grabbed his buddy that he knew worked in the atmospheric department, and they jumped on a plane and flew out there to test and see if this lightning superbolt phenomenon that they were just beginning to know about was actually a real thing, and that if it actually came all the way down to the ground. Now, there was nothing military about this. There was nothing secret about this. In fact, the guys spoke openly to the television reporters. Did you happen to include any of that on your show?
No, this is the first I'm hearing about a lot of this, and I'd never seen any of the television reports of them speaking. Basically, the story that I got from my research was that they were interviewing, you know, people who were at the Bickford farm and the fire inspector, but that they appeared to be very secretive about what they were there actually working on, and even said to when they were interviewing people, if the two inspectors wanted to talk to each other, the two people from Los Alamos wanted to speak, they would step away a little bit and they'd write notes on paper and show it to each other so that the people they were interviewing wouldn't hear.
I remember reading about that too. Yeah, but basically they didn't know what was going on yet. This was still new to them as well. And so they weren't exactly going to tip their hand or come out representing the United States government and saying, we think this is going on. So, I mean, they were just exercising a little bit of professional discretion. But yeah, I mean, later we've learned that that's a very real thing. Back in the 1970s, we weren't doing the same kind of data storage that we would be doing on this now. And so we couldn't really go back and look at the data. And so we can't prove that what happened at Bell Island was a lightning superbolt, but it has all of the signs that we would expect to see. It was clearly a very high voltage electrical disturbance on the ground with very high temperatures. It did some burning. It did some property damage. It showed up on the Vela satellites exactly in the way that we now know lightning superbolts do. So it's really probably the first example of a confirmed lightning superbolt that's not quite confirmed just because we can't go back and double check the data.
Yeah, and I guess that doesn't, just like with Oak Island, that doesn't really take away from how fantastic of an event it was, because I've never heard of anything else like this happening in the world as far as I know with this supercharged lightning or whatnot. To me, it's cool that something like this happened in Atlantic Canada. And the whole story, even if you believe it was supercharged lightning and it was a natural event, it's still a very cool story. And the fact that it happened on this small little island, you know, a mining, fishing type community, and, you know, blasted the Bickford farm and killed their chickens and, you know, scorched the wires like they described. they described the wire, that the electrical wire that ran from their house to the power lines out on the street. I guess the current that passed through it generated so much heat that it was just a bare copper or aluminum wire, and all the plastic insulation on the wire was just on the ground underneath it as dust. Now, I didn't see pictures proving this, but to me, that's just a very cool science fiction looking scene.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that people will immediately bring up when they hear this version, sort of the science-based version of what probably happened there, the things they'll bring up is all of the other weird reports that people made. Someone reported seeing a strange colored beam of light going off into the sky. There was a boy, wasn't he at the Bickford farm?
Yeah,
he saw the glowing ball of light.
The grandson was on a bike, and the glowing ball of light appeared in front of him, and then just disappeared as if it was never there.
Yeah, you know, there's no reason to think that these are all purely anecdotal reports. And when I say that, typically people go, "Oh, he's being a dismissive cynic." Well, no, an anecdotal report is a real thing. It's a report that's not testable. Someone just gives us a verbal story, all we can do is say, oh, well, that's very nice, but we can't really go back and double check it because we just have your word for it. That doesn't mean nothing happened. It just means there's nothing for us to examine and learn more. So it's nice that we have these anecdotal stories, but they're all over the map. Maybe some of them were real things that these people saw. We don't necessarily have any reason to think they were associated with the Bell Island boom. in any way. I mean, people in every town see or experience strange things every day. Who knows what they are? They're not necessarily connected. Bottom line is, whether they are or not, they're not something that we can use to help us build our picture of what probably happened on that day. So, yes, we're thrilled that there's these handful of strange, unexplained stories, but we can't do much with them. For the boy who saw a ball of light immediately after a lightning superbolt struck the ground within a short distance of him, I'm not surprised about anything he would report after that happening. Certainly his eyes are going to be blasted, and he's going to be seeing spots in front of his eyes. He's lucky he got away with that. He's lucky he didn't get burned. Mm-hmm. So I can't offer an opinion on that. I'm not dismissing it. I'm certainly not saying the boy was lying. I'm just saying we can't learn anything from that. So from the evidence that we do have, we have a pretty good picture of what happened that day.
Great. So again, you just like with Oak Island, I think you can put that in such basic terms and create such a compelling case for your explanation of it. I find your show, instead of Skeptoid, it needs to have like the word sobering or sober in it, because I find you get swept up with the mystery, and then at the end of it, you can just shut it down so good, and you're such a pro at it. I find it incredible, but you would be a terrible person to hang out with.
Yeah, I strive for that. Yes.
I picture you, you're out somewhere and it's time to get the flu shots, and somebody with you is like, oh, I don't get flu shots because I don't want to, you know, catch. I can picture you just blowing them away.
Oh, my gosh. That happened to me just the other day. I was in a McDonald's, and I'll just take 30 seconds of your time here. I was in a McDonald's. We were taking a road trip, so we stopped to pick up a quick lunch to eat in the car. You know, I'm at the drink machine filling up my Diet Coke. And some old guy standing there goes, oh, I just learned about drinks just this last couple of weeks. And then he starts going off on, did you know that liquid in America has 16 molecules per unit, but in Japan it has 24 molecules per unit? Now, for your listeners, that means nothing whatsoever. But this guy, he then goes on and on saying that all these drinks that we drink are all acidic. And acidity is the cause of cancer and all disease. And in Japan, they have alkaline water machines that they put in all the hospitals, so they have no cancer in Japan. And the FDA won't approve these machines because there's no money in people not having cancer.
Ouch.
So now, these are things that I've heard 1,000 times over the course of my career in the last decade dealing with this. So I could have written down everything he was going to say just before it came out of his mouth. And he just read down the checklist point by point. Check, 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 check. And people often say to me, you know, hey, it's one thing to deal with real important social issues, but there's no reason to debunk this really crazy weird stuff that people actually don't believe. Well, the fact is, people actually do believe this crazy weird stuff. And I don't know what changes this guy is making in his life. Obviously, he is now going to buy one of these alkaline water machines, which do nothing at all and cost thousands of dollars. That's going to hurt his pocketbook. And he's obviously retired and probably doesn't have a lot of money, or hopefully he would have been eating somewhere better than McDonald's. But it is important that people understand the concepts and the why we want to know what's real, why it's important to know what's real from what's not real. How we go about making those connections. What kind of basic science literacy do we need in order to follow these threads through? To me, it's fun, it's fascinating, and I think it has a real important value in society.
I appreciate your time so much here. I encourage any of my listeners who are interested in having a skeptical and sometimes sobering view of the world's mysteries, check out Skeptoid. And it's, and again, your show, it's not always mysteries and paranormal. Like you said, you do so much of the consumer protection and the, you know, bizarre medicine and all these sorts of things. But it's
yeah, there's four basic story ideas: conspiracy theories, urban legends, supernatural claims, and alternative medicine claims. And they're all great stories, and there's all really fun lessons to be learned behind each of them. There's 525 episodes. Nice. They're all free. They're there. Go for it.
That will conclude tonight's episode. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, you may be interested in joining the Patreon group, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. With that said, on behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's current supporters and welcome the newest members to the group, David, Ben, and Hannah. In addition to providing me great pride and motivation, your generous donations make this show possible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. To stay up to date with the show, please follow me at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast and on Twitter. My handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.